Salo Falava. I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
This is Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia.
Hello and welcome to Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Wendy Mocker. For Namila Benson, her voice has become her power. Whether she's hosting, writing, guiding artists, or using media to carve out space for Melanesian identities. From a childhood shaped by diaspora to becoming one of Australia's most respected broadcasters, Namila's story is one of courage, curiosity, and learning to stand in her own truth. Namila Benson, one of my favorite susas, welcome to Stories from the Pacific.
Susa, what an intro. Thank you so much. So kind.
Oh, you are worthy of so much more, my sister. Let's jump. I'd like to take it back to the beginning.
Sure.
I'm wondering, for our listeners, are you able to tell us where you were born and where do you call home?
My mother was pregnant with me when we came down to Melbourne, Australia. So I'm based in Melbourne. And home for me is actually Rabaul, East New Britain province in beautiful Papua New Guinea.
Oh, beautiful. And when you hear the word Rabaul, I'm wondering what sights and sounds come to mind.
I am from Rakunut villages and so close to the ocean. Mm. So the sound of the ocean is something I carry with me. I always feel the pull of it and the calling of the ocean because that salt water, we know what it does for us, right, Susa?
Yeah.
But the crackling of fire, the cooking of bananas or min min is always something that I just absolutely, there's something about that smell that speaks of home for me, but also to, I guess, the laughter of having all the cousin brothers and sisters around, the aunties and the uncles, all the bubus, like family is very much at the heart. There's a specific sound intermingled with the sound of the ocean and the crackling of fire that goes all day. That's what home means to me when I hear the word Rabaul.
Oh, you took me straight there then, sis. And now you made me hungry for banana. So I'm going to have to leave this and go to the market there and find myself some banana to eat after this. What do you hold closely from your Tolai roots? Like, what do you find still guides you today, even as an adult?
You know, that's such an amazing question because something that I've come to realize as I've gotten older is, and I know it sounds cliche to say the sense of community, but the ways that, I mean, it's a very formal Western word to use, consultation, but that is something that is deeply embedded in the heart of our Tolai culture. So every person from our elders right through to little kids are involved in that process of discussions and dialogues and decisions that are made, which impact everyone's life within the village. Mm-hmm. And I've noticed as I've gotten older, that is actually a way of being that I've brought very much into any workplace or space that I step into. So I think it is that collective approach. And I'm not saying anything new when I say that village life is not about the individual. It's very much about the collective. And I think my Tolai culture, especially coming from really incredible matriarchs, has, you know, like in my formative years, they really schooled me about what that process looks like and why it's important.
And is there a particular matriarch? Is there a family member or community member that was quite significant in your upbringing or development?
Absolutely. So my Bubu Tele Amos, who is my mum's mother, and when people talk about the saying, still waters run deep, that was so my Bubu. Mm. She was exceptionally kind. You know, I think people would say a lot about, we speak about emotional intelligence, and it's interesting, right, Susa? We've got language these days that really captures things that our elders put into practice and developed frameworks for, but we never actually had the language for it necessarily. But the way that she listened with a really beautiful stillness and heard so many people. I mean, you know, she was quite, she held quite a senior position and was deeply respected within the village and across our clan. And she, yeah, I mean, you know, I was about 12 when she sadly passed. Mm-hmm. She lived a long life, but the resonance of the essence of who she is continues in all of her bubbles. We all speak of her. She's very interwoven in my day-to-day life in a lot of ways, because I do often think, especially when you're navigating the world as part of diaspora, I think, what would Bubu do? I mean, I think that's what legacy work looks like when it comes to our matriarchs.
Yeah, 1,000%. And I'm also a big believer of, like, when our old people, our matriarchs, when they pass over, that they're also still with us.
Yes.
And you said, like, that you can, you know, still, I can still hear my Bubu. Like, if I'm doing something that I know I'm not supposed to be doing, she is very loud in my ear being like, what are you doing, child? Get yourself out of this place. You should not be speaking to someone like that. Like, they're very much still a part of our lives in a very big and very meaningful way, I find.
Oh, I so agree. And the wisdoms that they imparted to younger ones, which didn't necessarily make sense, you know, when I was younger, I still recall a lot of her words now, and really profound lessons have come from it. And just the way that, you know, because Bubu was shady as well, you know?
Them shady boo-boos, they'll get you every time, let me tell you.
Every time. But, you know, and I see it in all of my, like in my mum and my bonus mums, you know, all my aunties as well. They're exactly like, they're cut from the same cloth. And it's so beautiful to, you know, have matriarchs who really just kind of ground you in such significant ways. And they do the work of the Bubus in that way ongoing. And I see so much of my grandmother. I see my Bubu Tele, and I hear her in my aunties and my mum. And yeah, like, you feel kind of smug sometimes that you come from the bloodlines of powerful, majestic women like that. And I really do. Yeah.
So you mentioned before that, so you grew up in so-called Australia. Now, wondering, as growing up, was there a moment when you first realized that the world saw you differently to how you saw yourself?
So one thing that my brother did a couple of years ago, I've got my, I can't remember what you call the kindergarten photos, but you know how they do the series and they present it in the book, etc.
Yes.
So my mum has got my kindergarten book in our village back home. And so he took a few of the photos and from there and sent across snaps of them. And I was like, when you look at those photos, even at 4 years old, I was incredibly serious as a child, but that's not how I recall myself to be.
Right.
But what I have realized is what is captured in so many of my school photos and being within the education system, I think I must have felt like an outsider, because in many ways I recall myself being a very loud, overly confident, bossy child, but none of that is conveyed in these photos. I'm very serious. I'm never smiling for photographers. And I wonder if that was me responding to situations where I felt I was different and didn't feel safe.
Right. I guess, like, growing up in this place, how did it complicate or maybe deepen your relationship with your Melanesian identity?
So I grew up in a very white, well-to-do suburb. And it is that weird undercurrent where you sense and feel something. I've never seen Get Out, but I think it's a little bit of a Get Out feeling.
Yeah, perhaps.
You know that there's a weird energy that's there, and people kind of see you as different. I mean, you know, I think the usual kind of diaspora thing where people compliment you on your English, people want to touch your hair.
Oh, that old thing.
And, you know, like just the way they talk about darker skin in terms of food. You know, like chocolate covered coffee, blah, 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 golden. Exactly that, which was always really weird. And so I was the only black student at both of my schools, apart from when my older brother, who was a few years older than me, was at the primary school as well. But yeah, I mean, you're highly kind of cognizant, right, of the fact that you are different because you're ridiculed and bullied for your hair, your colour, skin, that kind of stuff. And it's like, you know, people will say, oh, you can't talk about racism with children. It's too early. Let kids be kids. But kids experience that stuff really early. And it does start early. I mean, I remember even with my elder child, I went to go and see, you know how you have your nursing appointments for the checkups in their first 2 years or what have you. And I remember walking into this quite small room for the nurse to check my son. And there was a tote bag that was hanging up that had a huge, ugly gollywog on it.
Oh, no.
Where do you start with that, Sousa? How do you begin to have that conversation in that moment when you're an exhausted mum, but it's your baby who's being put in the hands of someone that has created a situation that feels very triggering, but you don't even know how to explain it in the moment? So I think feeling different was something that it's ever present. It's like a constant reverberating hum where you know that your presence can really, you know, you can shift, you can sort of clock the shift in perceptions when you walk into rooms. And you and I both work in fields where it pains me to say it, but sometimes you are, in inverted commas, the only one.
Yeah.
Yep. Or even being the first. And that is, neither of those are places that you want to be.
Yeah.
You know, they're never pleasant.
It's just such a, it's such a fraught mental sort of, I guess, like mind space to always have to revisit or experience in so many sort of varying different ways. Was it something like broadcasting, radio, was that something you've always wanted to do? Like, do you remember as a child imagining this for yourself? Like, what dreams did you have growing up?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So I was very fortunate. The whole reason we came to Australia is because my father, Warren Benson, was part of, you know, the first crew of PNG journalists to be part of setting up Pacific Services, the Talk Pisin service for Radio Australia. So it's really interesting with radio, and I think many of us, or many people of my vintage, can say this. I knew the power of radio and its intimacy, its interactiveness, its immediacy, but also the fact that it was portable. When I would go home, my grandfathers and my uncles would always be listening to the radio. That was their lifeline and their connector to the rest of the world, and especially my grandfather. My pōpō was the way that he was so on the mark when it came to, like, he could debate anyone under the table about global issues and current affairs. And, you know, he was very tapped into politics, etc. And it was because of radio.
And did you find that your dad was, like, encouraging of you to enter that field? Was it something that he was, you know, hoping his daughter would also follow in his footsteps?
Not really. Dad was like lawyer or doctor. So that wasn't going to happen with me. But yeah, I mean, ever since I was a really little kid, I used to go into the studios with Dad. So he would be doing, you know, his live broadcasts from Melbourne across the region, right across the Pacific. And I grew very comfortable in the studios. So it wasn't anything that was scary to me, seeing that red light flashing. And I think what was really poignant in my life was seeing these exceptionally talented journalists and broadcasters who were all Melanesian. And I'm talking people like Auntie Kathy Sakias from Kaviang, Auntie Kene Kala from Central, Auntie Pia Killa, people like Uncle Pearson Vetuna as well, and Auntie Caroline Tiraman, who was also a Tolai woman. Wow. And being able to hold her own when it came to just such incisive and really kind of intellectual interviews, you know, when it came to politicians and doing it in, I guess, what is referred to often as the Melanesian way. She was able to get to the heart of so many crucial and important conversations, but doing so in a way that was still respectful, but also didn't let people off the hook.
Talk to us about your first, like I'm wondering, like about your first radio gig.
Ooh, yes. So back in 1993, I was doing a sociology and psychology degree, absolutely sucked at it and didn't really enjoy uni. But, you know, I kept feeling the calling of radio and I missed at that age. I was what? Yeah, like 19 or so, and obviously not going into the studios anymore to keep Dad company. But I thought, let me just see what's happening in community radio. So here in Melbourne, the community radio scene is so thriving. The sector is where many of us kind of cut our teeth in order to build bigger careers within media. And I went to a station, or I called up a station called 3CR. It was very, very radical and very political. And it ended up being a whole awakening on a number of levels. But I was like, let me just get a feel for the station, see if it's what I want to do and get to meet people a little bit. So I offered to just work on reception, volunteering. So I did that a couple of days a week. And one day, one of the presenters who ended up becoming one of my mentors, she couldn't make it into the studios. And back in the day, I used to walk around with my Discman. And so I had CDs on me and she couldn't make it in. So she rang and she's like, it was about half an hour before her show. And she said, Namila, I can't make it in. I'm going to need you to jump on air. And I had no experience. I didn't know how to work the desk. I'd sat in there with her a couple of times, but I had the huge pleasure of this time slot following on from two extraordinary First Nations Black women. So the aunties, Destiny Deacon and Lisa Bellier. And I didn't realize how absolutely iconic they were in the arts world because I knew them as broadcasters and they were the first Black women who I had ever witnessed being wholly themselves on air. So loud, so rude, so ridiculous at times, but just bringing their best selves to the mic and joyous to listen to and, you know, really, really used humour. Like there was an irreverent kind of approach they took to deeply serious topics, you know, and it was, they were kind of the first ones where when it came to Black politics in this country really made me aware of a lot of what was going on and gave me language to name a lot of the structural and institutional racism that was happening. But, you know, can you imagine what it was like stepping into a studio after them? So they very kindly stayed with me for an hour while I did this show. I was terrible. I was so nervous. I was so shaky. I was so terrible. My friends laughed at me afterwards. My sister mocked me endlessly, but I loved it.
Oh.
I absolutely loved it. So I went back again the following week because Jan MacArthur, who was this presenter and soon to be producer and mentor of mine, said, how did you go? How did you feel? And what I realized was that she did that deliberately. So it's really lovely, Sousa, you know, that feeling when people see potential in you that lays dormant somewhat. And so she's like, you've got a really important voice. And she said, there's not many people at the station who represent the community that you're from. And she said, I don't think there's any Papua New Guinean voices. Why don't you think about putting in for a show? And so I did all of that. I went through the process, really terrible at first, but then once you see that little light flashing on the phone and people are calling and they connect with something that you've said, or they want to share a memory of a song that you played, or there was a back announce where you mucked up and you made them absolutely crack up. Like, it's those kinds of moments of tenderness where people are just so kind and forgiving with you just having your L plates on, really.
Yeah.
But that's what feeds your desire to keep going back, because it is sort of tied in with ego, but more than anything, it's so tied in with connection. And radio was the one place where I felt I could completely be myself and would even share and hand over some quite intimate stories at times if I was responding to what was happening in the world. And then people connect with you.
You're listening to Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Wendy Mockey, and I'm speaking with the incredible Namila Benson. I'm wondering, how do you hold a tension between being visible for your community whilst also protecting your own peace?
So it's a work in progress.
Yes. You can tell me about that. Yep.
There is something so delicious about getting older and caring more for what I need to care for and caring way less for what doesn't serve me. And I'll be honest, I think perimenopause has played a huge part me being able to, like, what is going
on?
All of that. But let me tell you what a gift it's been for me. If something no longer serves me, I'm learning to let go. And I think it's okay. I also know the power of the pause has been huge for me. This year, I learned about a way of being, which is called WAIT, and that stands for Why Am I Talking? So I think in the past, I've felt such an urgency and a pressure to always be the one to kind of pacify a situation, to talk first, to jump in, to save people, this, that, and the other. And it never really served me. But now I'm very considered in when I choose to open my mouth, what I choose to get involved in or with. And that has served me really well. It's brought me a level of peace that I've not really quite felt before. But I think what has been very liberating for me is just remembering people are not thinking of me. When I am going, oh gosh, did I offend, blah, 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 people are not thinking of me. They got their own big lives that they're also trying to navigate, because we don't have a rule book for this crazy thing we call life.
Yeah.
And so that has freed me up in so many ways.
When you look at the artist and storytellers you've platformed, what gives you the most pride?
It sounds weird to say it, but I think, which I think is a very Melanesian thing, the ways that we are able to make people feel safe, to bring joy into a space. Now, I have to say that doesn't always make it to the screen, but behind the scenes, people share remarkable and really intimate stuff with us. And sometimes the decision I'll make is that can't go to air, because not every story is for every person. We know this. And I want people to know that I will, as much in my power as I can, I will treat their stories with such care. Unfortunately, doing a half-hour TV program at the moment, you know, it can be hard. TV is a brutal game in that way. It doesn't sort of allow for the slow burner beauty of, you know, getting wrapped up in a conversation and sort of evolving with a person throughout. But yeah, I think I feel really proud of the fact that my Melanesian heritage and my Tolai culture has taught me how to genuinely and authentically engage with people. I mean, I don't really, if I'm not really into a person's work and what have you, and there's room for all of us to exist within a space, but I find it hard to pretend. So sometimes I'll just pass a story on, or maybe it's better if another presenter takes the chat, because I also don't want to be disrespectful to people, you know? But yeah, I think people knowing that they will be genuinely seen, heard, appreciated, and treated with respect and dignity, that's one thing I feel really proud of.
And I can attest to that, as I've been on the other side. I've been the interviewee of many of your interviews. So I can attest to all those things. And I also think it's very Melanesian not being able to pretend.
True.
Outside of your work in media, I would like to know, who is Namila Benson?
Oh, gosh. So a very proud mum, an absolutely mad and keen music lover. And everyone goes on about FOMO, fear of missing out. I'm more about JOMO, joy of missing out, because I love doing cook-ups. So my big thing is just, yeah, spending time with family and friends. And yeah, we've got beautiful elders. My kids, absolutely wonderful. And, you know, they're tapped into a lot of really great interests. And I've got an extended community, I guess, in some ways through them. I feel like it's pretty consistent, Susa, culture, family and community, whether it's off screen or on, that's my big enduring love.
And when you picture the future you're working towards, what does it look, or sound, or feel like for you?
I think it's a future where we don't need the nonsense of language to define who and what we're supposed to be, serving a purpose for the status quo. So I do take issue with words like diversity and inclusion, even the way that intersectionality as a concept has been hijacked from Dr. Kimberley Crenshaw. You know, we should be able to exist and be recognised and honoured and given the dignity of what our skill set is and the amazingness that we bring to spaces that we enter into. But so often it can be a bit of a hindrance where people are not respectful of the incredibly high levels of skill that we bring into especially workplaces and projects, etc. So what my dear wish would be is that real equity comes through recognition rather than the convenience of continuing to serve a status quo that will never protect us.
Namila Benson, thank you so much for joining me on Stories from the Pacific. Thank you for walking a path that makes it possible for the rest of us to follow, and for teaching us that the most radical thing we can do is to tell our own stories with pride, and also to rest when we need.
Wendy Mocair, I cannot tell you how much of a thrill it's been to be interviewed by you. You're exceptional and extraordinary, and honestly, you're someone who I look to as well, and just deeply respect for the ways that you also show up for our people.
Oh, I'm going to try not to cry now, because I'll finish up the rest of this interview. That was Namila Benson, broadcaster, storyteller, living legend, Melanesian powerhouse. Thank you, my sister. You are incredible, and we are so much, 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 much more better that you are a part of us.
Back at you, Susa. Thank you, Susa.
You've been listening to Stories from the Pacific. I'm Wendy Mockey. To hear more stories about unique and incredible people from the Pacific, just search for Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. This story was produced and hosted on the lands of the Yuggera and Turrbal people.